Though the occupation of Iraq has become extremely unpopular both in this country and abroad, there is one group that's benefited greatly from it and is a model of what the Bush administration said it hoped to accomplish in the Middle East. The Kurds, who occupy the north of Iraq, have formed a Muslim region that is pro-democracy, pro-America, and even pro-Israel. But publicizing its success might throw the Middle East into turmoil. Quill Lawrence, the Middle East correspondent for the BBC and PRI, has written a book called Invisible Nation: How the Kurds' Quest for Statehood is Shaping Iraq and the Middle East. It's published by Walker & Company, and I'm very pleased that it has brought him to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
You note that America has a long history of betraying the Kurds, a record that changed, as you write, through two accidents by two presidents named Bush. What were those accidents?
Well, the first one was in the aftermath of what looked like a very neat little war in 1991 to kick Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait. After that, George Bush Sr., by his own admission, sort of went off script in some speeches and said, there's another way for this all to end. The Iraqi people could rise up and overthrow Saddam. Now, what he and his administration really wanted was for someone to put a bullet, the so-called one-bullet solution to Saddam. They wanted another Sunni Arab general to take over. But what happened instead is the Shiites in the south and the Kurds in the north rose up thinking that they had America at their backs. When these rebellions started, a lot of countries in the region and the United States, some of the realists in that government said, we don't want to see the chaos that might happen and perhaps inflate Iran's power in the region. So they cut the legs out from underneath this rebellion, and Saddam killed them in the tens of thousands. What was different about the Kurds is that there was enough outcry and enough reports got out to the media that Britain, the United States, and France were actually forced to act.
And then the second Bush?
Well, the second accidental liberation of the Kurds was going in 2003. The Bush administration, this is George W. Bush, had planned to go through Turkey with Turkish help and had accepted conditions including allowing something like 60,000 Turkish troops to come through, who would not probably have been very kind to the Kurdish enclave in the north. On March 1st, 2003, the Turkish parliament voted against allowing U.S. troops to come through and thereby in some ways won the battle of independence for Iraqi Kurdistan without firing a shot. At that point, America had no one else to depend on besides the Kurdish fighters in the north. And they flew in, they cooperated with U.S. special forces, and it set them off on sort of a honeymoon with the U.S. At the same time, it sent their rival, the Turkish government, into the doghouse.
There was another factor, the establishment of a no-fly zone in northern Iraq. That was the first President Bush and then the Clinton administration?
Right. That sort of explains the interim between those two accidental creating this de facto Kurdistan. In 1991, suddenly you had half a million of Kurds walking over the mountains. They had risen up against Saddam Hussein. The rebellion lasted a few days. They got as far as the city of Kirkuk, and then it became apparent that they weren't going any further. The Iraqi army started mopping them up. They had had bitter experience with Saddam Hussein. Throughout the 80s, he had a campaign that most people consider genocidal against the Kurds, including the gassing of the town of Halabja, which killed 5,000 people in a single day. They decided that they were better off walking, sometimes barefoot, across the mountains to Turkey or to Iran. I spoke with witnesses who saw scenes where people were walking out of hospitals holding IV bottles. Everyone just decided to get out of the north of Iraq. The Turks were not letting them through, but this refugee crisis inspired the first humanitarian intervention, which when the U.S. and Britain and France staged an intervention into northern Iraq and created a safe haven, which planted the seed of an independent Kurdistan.
And right now you say that they live under the equivalent of a de facto self-rule. But this is something that cannot be publicized?
Well, it's all good with the Iraqi constitution. As it was written in 2005. The trick is that the Kurds were instrumental in writing this constitution and that Sunni Arabs didn't really have much voice in it. So the Kurds are very happy with this constitution, but what they're happy about is probably unacceptable to at least many Sunni Arabs, and also the faction of Shiite Arabs led by Muqtada al-Sadr. So they under the Iraqi constitution, can have their autonomous government. They wrote in things to this constitution saying that their local laws trump national laws, that they can keep their own militia essentially as national guard, essentially enshrining their autonomy in the north. And with those provisos, they're happy to stay within Iraq.
My guest is Quil Lawrence, who is the Middle East correspondent for the BBC PRI's The World. He has spent much of the last 7 years in Iraq and in Kurdistan, and he's written a book called Invisible Nation, How the Kurds' Quest for Statehood is Shaping Iraq and the Middle East. Excuse me. It's published by Walker. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You've been making the distinction Arab-Sunni. That's because Kurds are also Sunnis, but they are a different ethnic group?
Predominantly Sunni. There are some Shiite Kurds. There's an old saying in the region that Kurds are only Muslims when compared to infidels. That might be a little bit unkind, but most Kurds laugh when you say that. They're much more moderate, and there is an Islamist current up there, but for the most part, there's alcohol is served in northern Iraq and most of Kurdistan. There's not the sort of feeling, I would say, from a personal perspective. Sometimes there are countries you can travel in where you feel as if you might make a faux pas, offend someone's religion, and end up, separated from your head. In Kurdistan, I feel very comfortable.
Well, it's odd because Saladin, who is one of the great heroes of Islam, was a Kurd. And wasn't he the first caliph?
Yes, Saladin.
So I would have thought that Muslims would have would revere the Kurds on some level. When did that change?
Well, the problem is really that no one remembers much that Saladin was a Kurd.
You mean other than me?
Well, no. People in the region know it, but he's known as a great defender of Islam, and he clearly chose that was his calling. He was going to restore Jerusalem to Muslim rule. He's considered even by the West to be an enlightened ruler. He's the only Muslim who was in, even in Dante's Inferno, he's listed as one of the righteous heathens who was waiting to in purgatory. So he responded to this call of Islam, and Kurds have a really mixed relationship with him. On the one hand, he's really the only famous Kurd there is, and if you have a magazine article about Saladin, you'll get 100 angry letters from Kurds saying, why didn't you emphasize that he's a Kurd? He's a Kurd. And then, again, when you talk to some Kurdish nationalists, they'll say, if Saladin had fought for Kurdistan instead of for Islam, we would be living in a great empire like Persia.
So. Well, why are they Kurds first and Muslims second? What happened? And the other question is, if they're not Arabs and they're not Turks, what are the Kurds? What is their ethnic group? Where do they come from?
It's a good question. Kurds go way back in history. Some people say that one of the three wise men was a Kurd. But it's these days.
Are there Kurdish Christians?
Yes, there are. But these days you could probably just say anyone who says they're a Kurd and speaks one of the Kurdish dialects is a Kurd. I've heard stories of people who were sneaking out of Syria or Iraq, and they didn't even know they were in a car full of Kurds until someone said a few Kurdish words. So
it's linguistic and cultural more than anything else at this point.
There are some physical features, but for the most part, it's a people that's caught between Turkey and the Arabs and the Persians. They all know they're not part of that group, and they haven't been treated very well by any of those three necessarily.
Well, how do they define themselves?
Anyone who speaks Sirani or Kurmanji would be considered a Kurd. They consider they have a great history that goes back, as I said, to biblical times. And there's a lot of Kurdish proverbs, a Kurdish character, which is somewhat different from the Arab character. But it's very hard to say, and it's hard to define. And that makes it, I think, very difficult for people in America, because you say, well, they're Muslims, but they're not Arabs. It's confusing, I think. You can't put them in a box very easily.
And you point out that the Kurds are the largest ethnic group on earth without a homeland. Now, why has that received less attention than the situation of the Palestinians or the Kosovars?
The Kurdish rebels and resistance fighters in the 70s said that they had gotten less attention than Palestine, for example, because they always kept it local. They didn't. They resisted the temptation when airline hijacking came in vogue. They made a pretty conscious decision after some flirtation with the idea of committing that sort of act to get attention and to strike out at their enemies. They decided not to go that route.
But they did later because they went after Turkey very specifically.
Well, yeah, that we'd be talking about the Turkish-Kurdish group, the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, which has gone that route, indiscriminate attacks, that sort of thing. My book is specifically about the Iraqi Kurds, and they made a conscious decision in their leadership not to do that, and they think that it's paid off quite well because it leaves them without this sort of stigma. No one has to, I guess, worry about talking to the Kurds on that front. I mean, there are other red lines, sensitivities in the region, specifically with Turkey. It'll upset the Turkish government if you go and talk to Kurdish leaders.
So do the Iraqi Kurds see themselves as distinct from the Turkish Kurds or the Iranian Kurds?
In the markets in northern Iraq, you can buy a map that will show you Kurdistan stretching all the way from Azerbaijan to the Mediterranean, a bit of an exaggeration, I think. But they consider it to be one people. They have a lot of the same myths. The languages are very different, and now they've been living apart, separated by these borders that were created after World War I, for long enough that distinct cultures are emerging. In Turkey, for example, many people will say, even in Iraq, I've heard people say that they think the Turkish Kurds have it the worst. And I couldn't believe it when I heard this, because certainly Turkey's Kurds have never been gassed like Saddam Hussein did to the Iraqi Kurds.
Now, why did he gas them? Did he see the independence movement as a threat to his power?
This was in the midst of the Iran-Iraq War. And the specific gassing in the town of Halabja was part of that war. There were Iranian troops in the city of Halabja at the time.
But Kurds were fighting in his army, in Saddam's army.
There were some Kurdish tribes who were fighting on his side, and there was a huge Kurdish resistance movement throughout the 80s. Saddam eventually decided to take the old anti-guerrilla strategy of separating taking the water from the fish, and razed thousands and thousands of villages in the north, and it really became hard to tell whether he was fighting the rebels or fighting every single Kurd.
Have Kurds always been in this area?
They go way back in history.
So when the Europeans were carving up the Middle East and they said, okay, this is Syria, and they drew a line, and they said, this is Iraq, and they drew another line, why didn't they draw a line that said this is Kurdistan?
Well, there was. There's a little-known outside Kurdistan treaty, the Treaty of Sèvres, which did provide for an independent Kurdistan. After that, in the ruins of the Ottoman Empire, Turkey sort of was scrabbling itself together to make a functioning state, protested, and Europe really didn't have the stomach to fight for the sake of the Kurds. Britain had also annexed the northern province of Mosul along to its new country called Iraq, which seemed like a very wise move to them once they discovered that it was pumping oil.
So oil was a major factor in how these lines were drawn.
It happened at about the same time. They realized there was oil in Mosul and in Kirkuk.
My guest is Quil Lawrence, who is Middle East correspondent for The World, the BBC PRI show, the news service. He has spent much of the last 7 years in Iraq and Kurdistan. He's reported for National Public Radio, Los Angeles Times, Christian Science Monitor. And now he's written a book called Invisible Nation, How the Kurds' Quest for Statehood is Shaping Iraq and the Middle East. It's published by Walker. We will continue our conversation after this. Did you know that you can not only hear guests on the show, but you can also see some of them as well? We have posted video clips of some of our recent favorite guests, like Herschel Walker, Phil Donahue, and Isabel Allende, and you can see them by going to WNYC.org and clicking on video. We're back with Quil Lawrence, whose book, Invisible Nation, How the Kurds' Quest for Statehood is Shaping Iraq and the Middle East, is published by Walker. Well, How have the Kurds been doing now that much of the tension has been south of them? There's been Sunni on Sunni violence. There's been Shiite on Shiite violence, and there's been a lot of talk about a civil war between the Sunni and the Shia.
Well, the Kurds have been quietly doing very well. One of the biggest problems in the north, I would have to say right now, is urban sprawl. They're building as far as the eye can see. They've got some investment coming in, a lot of Turkish businesses actually coming in. There hasn't been a single U.S. soldier killed in the north during all of this insurgency, and they've actually been called upon to help out.
The Peshmerga, the Kurdish militia?
Exactly. They were resistance fighters, but in the last 15 years before the invasion, or rather the last dozen years before the invasion, they became an organization with a lot more command and control, and they're now helping out with the surge. When I've been embedded with U.S. Army units, you'll often see Kurdish fighters, and the U.S. soldiers will say, these guys get it.
So they obviously must feel that there's something to be gained by this cooperation with the United States and its allies, and people in the south do not see something. Well, there have been some Sunni militias that have joined with the U.S. military as well, but they don't seem to be as committed. Is there something to be gained?
Absolutely. The Kurdish leadership are very pragmatic. They all tell you straight out they would rather have their own country, but they know they need to stay within Iraq because none of the neighbors will allow them to form an independent Kurdistan. So they need the United States to stay, and they need the United States to succeed in order to stay. They would love to have a U.S. base up there in the north, but the U.S. Army is the only thing protecting them from the outside powers. And they see that if they could be part of an Iraq that was functioning and they had what they need, their rights guaranteed, well, then they would be taking a share of the oil wealth in Baghdad. They would be sharing a capital of Baghdad. They'd be part of a prosperous nation.
Well, they have a lot of the oil, so it's in their best interest to be able to have a certain amount of autonomy. But has this been as ideal as it's been sounding? Hasn't there been violence by the Kurdish security forces against their own people?
Oh, for years, I would say the Kurdistan, both parties up there have security apparatuses you'd have to consider quite oppressive. They don't pass human rights muster. On the other hand, they are subject to this sort of pressure, which is interesting. They're one of the groups in the region and also in Iraq where they really dependent on the outside world's opinion of them as being pro-democracy and moving in that direction. So whereas you can't really tell people in Fallujah that they're violating human rights, and you can't even really say that to the country of Saudi Arabia, for example. It doesn't have a whole lot of effect to pressure them that way. The Kurds are really dependent on American approval and international good reputation. So they are subject to some coercion on the human rights issue.
But they have these two contending groups, political parties, and for years there have been attempts to work out more cooperation. Why has it been so difficult?
Personalities, really. There was one big Kurdish rebel party back in the 70s led by a mythical warrior, Mullah Mustafa Barzani. He finally, in 1975, stopped fighting and then actually died in exile in the United States. And then there was a schism. Jalal Talabani, who's the current president of Iraq, formed another party that at the time was more left-leaning, socialist-leaning. And Barzani's son, at sons at the time, but his son Massoud kept going with the other party. And these two parties are really nearly indistinguishable in what they want to achieve. One, you could say Jalal Talabani's party is a little bit more modern and a little bit more multilingual, a little bit less tribal. But they fought idiotic wars throughout the 90s, cost their own people thousands of unnecessary deaths. The only thing they really achieved was the knowledge that they couldn't wipe each other out militarily.
And then you say the Halabja Memorial to the victims of the 1988 gas attack was severely damaged because they had a skirmish, these two groups, in March of 2006, just 2 years ago.
That's a different issue. I would say, just to finish, that the Kurdish parties, the tension between those parties is now largely a political fight, and they're having some cooperation. The sacking of the Halabja Memorial was something quite shocking. This is a memorial built at the gate to this city where this terrible massacre took place in 1988. It was inaugurated with Colin Powell in attendance and said to be a symbol that this thing would never happen again. No one would ever forget Halabja. The problem was they built this memorial at the gate to the city, and all the visitors, whoever came, would just go to the memorial, and then they would be shepherded away by the Kurdish government, who really didn't want them to see that the rest of the town of Halabja, which it should be said had some Islamist currents in it, so it wasn't a well-favored town by either of the parties. The rest of the town of Halabja didn't have any pavement. It didn't have any basic services. Finally, the people there got fed up, and on one of the anniversaries, they went down to protest. The Kurdish security forces came out, shot into the crowd. This caused them to riot. One young man was killed. And the crowd got so angry that they sacked their own memorial. And the last time I was there anyway, it still scorched and burned.
But you haven't felt any danger in Kurdistan in the way that reporters describe feeling constantly endangered in Baghdad and other parts of the country.
No, it's night and day. You can still do journalism in Kurdistan. You can still just go out and meet people, ask them their story. You have to take careful watch about where the new line is between the Kurdish Autonomous Zone and the rest of Iraq. And driving down, for example, into the city of Kirkuk, you're suddenly into a red zone where a wrong move could really cost you.
What role do the Kurds play in the current Iraqi government?
Jalal Talabani, who was a mountain rebel for many years, is now the president of Iraq, and just an incredibly unlikely turn of events in history.
Well, is that a significant position for him to have? After all, the prime minister is the one who makes most of the decisions.
It wasn't supposed to be all that significant a position, but especially when he took it after the first temporary government and became part of this permanent term government, he insisted on having more of a role. And the meetings I've attended where Talabani is convening a national security meetings, it's very clear who's in charge. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki is now seeming to assert himself, but for the first couple of years, he was really hard not to upstage. And it was clear when you saw Talabani and Maliki together who was running things. The Kurds have a dozen years more experience than the rest of Iraq at this sort of politics, international politics. And so a better example might be Hoshyar Zebari, who's been the Kurdish foreign minister since the first post-invasion government was formed. And he had spent the previous 15 years jetting about international capitals trying to raise awareness for the Kurdish cause and against Saddam Hussein. So he already knows how to do this. He can speak at least four languages fluently, and he's remained the Iraq's foreign minister because he's very good at his job.
Who do the Kurds fear most, the Sunni insurgents or someone like Muqtada al-Sadr?
In fact, I would have to say that the Kurds I speak to fear the Turks more than either of those. From inside,
and the Turks have invaded a few times.
Exactly, and their question is whether the Turks are invading northern Iraq in order to go after the PKK, this militant group that does launch these cross-border raids, or whether they're coming in to try and smack down the beginning of this strong autonomous Kurdistan.
Well, but we have Jalal Talabani having some kind of a working relationship with President Bush. You open your book by describing a meeting in 2005, September, in Washington between the two of them. And Turkey still has to try to be on the good side of the United States, doesn't it?
Well, Turkey has always outweighed the Kurds in the equations of diplomacy. And it's always been, there'll be examples of Kurdish leaders being invited to the State Department and then getting stood up at the door because of Turkish pressure on the State Department. Turkey is an enormously important ally for the United States. It's also the example of a Muslim democracy. It's a huge country compared to a very tiny Kurdistan, and it has always won out on that bet. Lucky for the Kurds, the Turks made a couple of moves in 2003 that really angered the Americans, not only not allowing their troops to go through Turkey, but that summer, July 4th, 2003, some Turkish commandos were apprehended, apparently up to no good, trying to stir up trouble in the city of Kirkuk. This wasn't the first time it had happened. And on this particular occasion, July 4th, 2003, the U.S. Army soldiers who apprehended them weren't in a very forgiving mood, and they sent them home to Ankara with their heads under black hoods and in plastic cuffs, as though they were sending them off to Guantanamo. This is something that has a singular event that has caused bad blood and changed Turkish public opinion towards America.
Why haven't we heard more about this? Do you think this whole story is being covered as well as it could?
Well, people, I guess in terms of the coverage, people go to Kurdistan and they do the one story. They say, look how nice things are in Kurdistan. And then usually they leave. Some people stay because it's really the only place in Iraq right now that you can move freely and do the sort of journalism that, well, journalists enjoy doing, where you can actually go out and report stories. But it's something you would think Washington would be crowing about. As you were saying, it really is everything they said they were going to bring to the region. It's not a perfect democracy yet, but it's definitely headed in that direction with some coaxing. But Washington has to be pretty quiet about this. And you'll hear State Department officials, as a matter of fact, in an interview with a very senior State Department official, he wouldn't say the word Kurdistan. He would say the Kurdish region. It's called the Kurdistan region, but that word Kurdistan really sets the Turks on edge. So they're still tiptoeing around that.
Just the Turks, or would it also upset our Saudi allies, our allies in any allies we have in Jordan or in Lebanon?
It's not such a direct threat to Saudi or to Jordan. Certainly Iran has a large Kurdish population that Turkey, Syria has a small Kurdish population. The United States is still worried about offending them. But
if anything, we'd probably want to encourage the Kurds to make it difficult for the Iranian government.
Well, that is going on with some Iranian Kurdish splinter groups. But the big point for the region is that nation building is a zero-sum game. You can't invent land. It's like the old saying says, they aren't making any more of it. So if Kurdistan is going to be invented, it's going to be taking away from Iraq, from Syria, from Turkey, from Iran, and they won't let this happen.
My guest is Quil Lawrence, who's written a book called Invisible Nation, How the Kurds' Quest for Statehood is Shaping Iraq and the Middle East. It's published by Walker. Well, when Joe Biden was on the show, we talked about his suggestion for some kind of a soft partition of the country. Is that the solution? It's been rejected by the White House and by an awful lot of other people. Do you see that as what's really happening or the ultimate solution?
I don't know about a solution in Iraq right now. And the surge, the jury's still out on whether that has given any breathing room to help Iraq move forward. But what is still happening and what is allowed under the Iraqi constitution is for these autonomous regions to be formed. And what Biden was suggesting, and many other people around the same time and before him were saying, that you could make these federal regions a loose confederation where you would have Kurds, Sunnis, and Shiites with their own ways in different. And it wouldn't mean the breakup of Iraq. Their idea is that it'd be a federal system with three different states. But that's not really all that easy to accept in the region, especially because the Shiite federal region in the south, which is something that the dominant Shiite parties are trying to form, would be seen essentially as an Iranian satellite state.
Well, that kind of partition didn't work well in Yugoslavia, even though they had 70 years or so to try to work it out. It is a problem, especially when there's an unequal distribution of natural resources.
The idea would be, and under the Constitution, is to bind these three groups together by the fact that the central government would control oil revenues. So certainly the Sunni Arabs would want to stay inside Iraq because there's not a whole lot of oil under their sand. The Kurds would also want to stay in because they, even if they get the city of Kirkuk inside their region, which is problematic, they're not going to have the sort of oil wealth that the city of Kirkuk probably has as much oil as Qatar or something. The reserves are all, the estimates are all over the place. But it's definitely beneficial for the Kurds to stay in. They would get a greater share of the huge reserves that are known to be in the center and south of Iraq.
You've called your last chapter Visible Nation, in contrast to the title of your book, Invisible Nation. What are you trying to say there?
Well, it's getting a little bit harder for them to deny how independent they are. And I think many Kurds feel that they'll just keep on saying, yes, we're part of Iraq, yes, we're part of Iraq. And perhaps they're thinking, and not so many of them would be sad, if the rest of Iraq simply fell off in this sort of civil war, the strife that we saw last year that has slowed down some. But it is getting harder for them not to admit that they are functioning almost as a separate government. They have their own parliament. They have their own laws. They have their own militia.
What will happen to the Kurds if the civil war in Iraq escalates?
They can hold their own territory against any outside threat. And with the exception of some territories, there are some disputed territories that where fighting could break out. And certainly the multi-ethnic city of Kirkuk, which the Kurds claim, would be a flashpoint. But they're not so worried about fighting within. They have the biggest army after the British contingent inside Iraq. They're worried about regional powers getting involved, and then regional powers like Iran wanting to peel one Kurdish faction off and interfering. It's an age-old practice in the region. They would be worried much more about nearby armies that have tanks and helicopters.
Would they be amenable to the establishment of an American military base there that would have a certain permanence?
Oh, they would love it. That for them would be the ultimate protection, meaning that outside powers couldn't intervene. They would be safe. It's probably the only place in the region I could think where an American soldier, a GI, could walk down the street and just be adored, receive flowers, and sit out on the curbside of a restaurant and have a cold beer in the sun. The problem, of course, and if you see in all of these proposals for possible bases, they're never in Kurdistan. There's been a very light footprint up there because they don't want to upset the Turks.
We have about 10 seconds to go, but did Kurds have a foreign policy?
Absolutely. Their policy is to put out the good word about how well things are going in Kurdistan.
And Quil Lawrence will be giving a talk and signing books tonight at 5:30 at the Carnegie Council. That's at 170 East 64th Street between 3rd and Lexington Avenues. His book, Invisible Nation, How the Kurds' Quest for Statehood is Shaping Iraq and the Middle East, is published by Walker. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you. That was my pleasure.
On tomorrow's show, we look into the risk that the Earth will become uninhabitable for humans in the near future. Also, the history of bird watching in America from colonial times to the present. Fiona Mazel with her debut novel. And we'll look into why debates can be a healthy part of the political process, even if they become stupid sometimes. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blake Neeshick, Sarah English, and Scott Goldberg. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Stephanie Hughes and Paula Crossfield. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening, and happy Earth Day.